This paid commercial may not represent the views of Hubbard Broadcasting Incorporated or Federal News Radio. Statements and opinions of this broadcast are solely those of individual contributors or advertisers as indicated. Federal News Radio does not take responsibility for those statements or opinions and accepts no responsibility or liability for any inaccuracy, errors, or omissions reported during this program.
Welcome to Bloomberg Government's Capital Impact on Federal News Radio, 1500 AM. My name is Alan Scott. This is where government actions meet business decisions. Online at www.bgov.com and on the air Thursdays at 11 and Fridays at 2:30 p.m. Well, it's time for them to get back to work. New members of the House and Senate have been sworn in, and the task at hand is kind of getting their bearings on the politics of Washington, D.C. Well, of course, that, hiring staff and figuring out why they got themselves into this in the first place, but that's for another story. What does all this mean for the president as he's gearing up for the inauguration? The House and Senate are still split, so decisions will still be a matter of debate, just like they were in the previous Congress. Budget and congressional analyst Cameron Luthy, along with chief legislative analyst Lauren Duggan, will join me in a little while to discuss what we can expect from the 113th Congress. But we'll kick off the program with a discussion of money. Yes, we're bringing the cash in 2013 here on Capital Impact. I've got 8 contracting opportunities worth over $100 million each. $1 billion in 2013 contracting opportunities with, of all places, NASA. Joining me now with more is Matthew Zisman, aerospace analyst with Bloomberg Government.
Thank you.
So I got to tell you, I haven't paid a whole lot of attention to the NASA space, and shame on me. I open up BGov a few days ago, and I see a lead story there, NASA to offer $1 billion in contract opportunities. And I go, wait a minute, shuttle program's gone. I read all kinds of stories about scientists, you know, people just out of work down along the space coast. And they've got all this money. Tell me more.
Well, I think obviously there was a transition from the shuttle program. And, you know, in many ways, NASA is still going through that transition. What we did was we focused on the largest contracts, those worth over $100 million. But in total, NASA actually has 300 different opportunities in the current fiscal year. And those total, at a low-end estimate, over $4 billion. You know, they have roughly a $17 billion budget. It's been fairly flat the last few years, but almost 80% of NASA's budget is contracted out. What's really interesting about the 3 new opportunities that we're looking at here is they really demonstrate NASA's commitment to deep space exploration. They've got a cryogenic propellant storage contract, but really what that means is how do we store rocket fuel to allow us to go beyond the moon, right? So if you're going to get to Mars, that's a lot of fuel.
Sure.
You need a way to store all that in the harsh environment of space.
Sure.
But 2 other contracts are also very interesting. One is the second phase of commercial crew certification. Right now, we actually contract with the Russians, of all folks,
right,
to bring our astronauts to space. And we've spent about $2 billion in the last 2 years. Well, Sierra Nevada, Boeing, and SpaceX are all working to develop commercial crew capability.
Right.
This second phase of the contract here that they're supposed to release this year will actually indicate the company or companies that are successful and are most likely to carry our astronauts into space and reach the space station for the next few years.
Now, will this end up like a multi-award contract where you've got all this money and all of these companies could benefit in some way?
It could end up as a multiple award. What NASA has done on its commercial resupply is they've actually signed contracts with Orbital and SpaceX for a specific amount of services.
Okay.
Right? So what you're likely to see is, if I were to guess, at least 2 of the 3 companies that are working on commercial crew will see contracts, and they'll probably be specified in the next contracts of how much service they'll provide NASA. And then the last contract that's coming up is one for hosted payloads. And this is another interesting opportunity where it's basically NASA looking to hitch a ride, if you will, on commercial satellites for its research equipment and its experiments. But what's interesting is the Air Force is also looking to do the same thing. So you see this effort in government to procure launch services from a wider range of vendors, but you're also seeing hosted payloads, which is really a partnership between the public and private sectors to reduce launch costs, reduce the access costs for space, and this allows everybody to put equipment up. And, you know, in this day and age of cell phones, of remote sensing, of drones, of DirecTV, satellite equipment is critical.
Yeah, I like the way we have our priorities straight. Cell phones, drones, DirecTV, you know, all the things that are necessary to keep the country running.
Well, it's funny because one of the challenges is for somebody like the Air Force, you can imagine there are all these satellites going up for, you know, commercial television, commercial radio. But listen, if you're the Air Force and you need reconnaissance and it's the Super Bowl, you got to be careful because the company you hitch your ride on, despite the national security challenge,
they're making money off the commercials being broadcast on that very satellite you want to use.
Exactly.
Understood. So we're looking at the three new opportunities worth over $100 million in fiscal 2013. It's the Glenn Research Center, for those of you playing along at home. That's the cryogenic propellant storage and transfer technology. My favorite is with the Kennedy Space Center, the Crew Transportation System Certification Contract Phase 2. I think I read in there somewhere it said, eventually, after you've gotten it to the point where we feel comfortable, we'll put our astronauts in it. That one kind of amused me. And then locally, the Goddard Space Flight Center, rapid payload rideshare acquisition. I like that one. It's like a slug line for space.
That's a good way to look at it.
All right, so we still have five other opportunities that are out there existing, available for recompete. And something that you mentioned here in your study, by the way, we're speaking with Matthew Zisman, aerospace analyst with Bloomberg Government, who's recently penned $1 billion in 2013 NASA contracting opportunities. Look for it on BGov now. 47% a possibility of you beating out the incumbent.
Yeah, and this is important because, you know, a lot of agencies form very tight relationships with their contractors. It's understandable. Mm-hmm. You know, the companies understand the agency culture. They understand the programs. They have a history. Also, the personal relationships that develop over time. But NASA seems very willing to reach out to a wide range of service providers. And I think that's important. And, you know, they have small business set-asides. But also, you know, one of the contracts that we weren't able to put in this study was the testing and operations support contract. It was a $900 million contract that Boeing had. It was recently awarded, in fact, it was awarded in December, which is why we had to drop it out of the study, to Jacobs Engineering. And it's now a $1.4 billion program that'll go through 2022. But, it, you know, there they shifted from incumbent Boeing to Jacobs Engineering. So it shows that NASA is willing to reach out and contract small and large to new vendors and make sure that it keeps a strong industrial base capable of meeting the many needs that the agency has.
NASA looking to diversify its portfolio, so to speak, with regard to contractors. When you look at a large company like a Lockheed Martin or a Raytheon, these companies that have been around for a long time, and they're building things that are going up into space and sustaining life and such, I put that next to a company like SpaceX, who's only been around for a little while, Elon Musk's little baby, puts it together, and now he literally out of nowhere is creating things that can go into it almost, it's like the American dream.
You know, SpaceX is really an interesting case because, you know, as I said, there's only a few companies that can really do this type of work.
Sure.
SpaceX is a new entrant.
Yeah.
And it's really amazing, not only the fact that they've been as gutsy as they have, but they've been successful. And they're doing it at a lower cost. Mm-hmm. So, you know, in the airline industry, they called it the Southwest effect. But, you know, Southwest would come in and lower the cost for a market, and the large incumbent carriers had to play catch-up. I think it will be interesting to see how, in particular, Boeing and Lockheed respond. Because SpaceX is so far successful, and they're doing it at lower cost. Now, Orbital is also trying to come onto the scene. So we'll see if Orbital can also deliver. But it increases competition. But I think the main message of all of this is that despite the challenges of the space program in terms of its vision for exploration and how to do that, the real application of space and the continuing reliance on satellite technology and the increased number of vendors who can get us into space means that this industry is actually in a pretty dynamic period. And it'll be very, very neat to see how it plays out and what changes in the market you see as a result of new entrants like SpaceX, the reduction in costs and the opportunities that presents.
I look at SpaceX as the kids in the backyard building that rocket, saying, yeah, we can do this. And I love it. I absolutely love it. I know that as these changes come about, you'll be back to detail them for us.
Will indeed.
Very good. His name is Matthew Zisman, aerospace analyst with Bloomberg Government. His latest study, $1 billion in 2013 NASA contracting opportunities, is available now. You're listening to Bloomberg Government's Capital Impact on Federal News Radio, 1500 AM. So to help us dissect what's on the table when Congress return next week are Cameron Luthy, budget and congressional analyst, and of course, Lauren Duggan, chief legislative analyst, both of whom are with Bloomberg Government. Gentlemen, thanks for returning to the program.
Thanks for having us.
So the fiscal cliff, big talk as the year ended, the year begins, still hearing talk of fiscal cliff. Did we go over? How far did we go over? Did we hurt ourselves when we did? Get us up to speed here.
Well, we went over a little bit, but okay. There was kind of a bungee cord attached to our ankle and we got pulled back pretty quickly. December 31st was the deadline for some of the tax provisions that were part of the fiscal cliff. Technically, the bill wasn't passed until January 1st in the House and the Senate, so we went over a little bit but came back. Most people won't have been affected by that one-day thing. To be fair, there is one part of the fiscal cliff that did take effect, and there seems to be no plan to do anything about it. That's the payroll tax cut.
Yeah.
For the last 2 years, most people have had 2 percentage points fewer taken out of their paycheck. So if you've already gotten your first paycheck for 2013, you'll notice there's a little less money than you had last year.
And I thought it was my 401k. Right. How dare they?
Well, that would have been your decision.
That's true. So no plans on addressing this anytime soon is what
well,
you're saying.
That's not true. I mean, we have a 2-month delay in the sequestration. That's mm-hmm. the code word for the automatic cuts that were due to take effect to defense and non-defense spending. That won't happen until March 1st now. So for the next 2 months, Congress is going to be debating more or less how to address that new deadline for the automatic spending cuts.
And there are other deadlines that come into play in the next couple of months, the first of which is the debt ceiling, which we've already hit, but the Treasury is exercising its powers to use extraordinary measures to prevent us from going over and still having enough to pay the bills. That deadline is probably going to run out about the end of February. So you've got another forcing function coming up, and then Congress has provided part-year funding for the federal agencies. That runs out March 27th. So you have some other deadlines, some other pieces of what's become a fiscal staircase, perhaps, coming up on the near horizon.
So you just hit on something, Cameron. These are decisions that had been taken up in 2012, some things that they were planning on trying to resolve. Nobody could come to a conclusion on them, figure out how we're going to address them. And it leads me to the cover of this week's Bloomberg Business Week. I don't know if you've seen this yet, but the cover, babies, the politics of the fiscal cliff are outrageous. The economic thinking is even worse. I just want to get your reactions on this.
It's a nice piece of artwork.
Yeah, nice piece of artwork. Basically, it's showing the chamber of the House of Representatives, and every seat is filled with an infant. Are we moving this infantile thinking now into 2013?
Well, I'd say that that's a little unfair. First of all, I think there are some very clear-headed and responsible members of Congress.
Understood. And I don't, this is a blanket statement by putting a baby in, well, almost every seat.
And second, I'd say that the lack of clear-headed thinking about the economy is pervasive. What we've had is we've had a political environment that's been created wherein deficits and dealing with them now has become more important almost than jobs and the broader economic growth pattern. If you talk to major macroeconomics experts, they will tell you that government retrenchment, just as we're coming out of a recovery, will harm the economy. CBO's analysis said if we go off the fiscal cliff, and by that they meant if taxes all go up because of the expiration of the Bush tax cuts, mm-hmm. and government spending is cut back because of the sequester that Lauren referred to, we will take a dip in the economic GDP growth. So it's fascinating the degree to which the politics are all about the deficit, but economists are telling you, really, that's not what you should be focusing on right this minute.
Right. And Congress was the one that set the deadlines for the spending cuts to take effect and for the tax cuts to run out. That's not the part that was the cliff. It was the effects that were really the cliff that people were talking about. What would happen to the economy if you pulled this much money out at once?
John Boehner said in a formal statement, "The American people reelected the president and reelected our majority in the House. If there is a mandate, it is a mandate for both parties to find common ground and take steps together to help our economy grow and create jobs, which is critical to solving our debt." I don't think anybody disagrees with that.
Right.
But when you take a look at the actions of Congress over the past 3 months or so, these guys can't agree on anything.
Well, I've been saying since the election that it was a status quo election. You have Democrats in charge of the Senate, a Democrat in the White House, and Republicans in charge of the House. And the majorities, while different on the margins, you know, two extra Democrats in the Senate, fewer Republicans in the House.
Let's not forget the undecided and independents.
Well, exactly. but in that extent, you have the same people returning. Now,
Understood.
As a personal member of Congress, you can come back and say my positions are vindicated because my constituents reelected me. And the president can say that the country as a whole reelected him. People still believe in their position, and it's hard to move from some of these things. If you don't believe that taxes should be raised, it's hard to step back from that. And similarly, if you've said with a line in the sand, we can't let these spending programs be cut, it's going to be very hard at this point to do it. We saw in the deal that was reached, brokered by Mitch McConnell and the vice president, mm-hmm. that there was an agreement finally to raise taxes on certain people, or at the very least let the tax rates expire on income levels of more than $400,000 or $450,000. That's a pretty big deal in a lot of ways. We hadn't had a tax increase like that in, I think some people think, 22, 25 years about. So that alone was a pretty big development. The tax question has been settled a lot, at least on the personal income tax.
Mm-hmm.
I think there's a lot to be said about corporate tax reform, and people like Dave Camp and Max Baucus are going to still try and pursue that, and maybe there's room for common ground. But spending is where things are really going to shift in the next 2 months as we hit those initial deadlines, and then going forward if there's some grand reform bargain to be had. Although we've seen where we've gotten with attempts to get grand bargains in the last 2 years.
You're listening to Bloomberg Government's Capital Impact on Federal News Radio, 1500 AM. My guests right now are Chief Legislative Analyst Lauren Duggan and Cameron Luthy, Budget and Congressional Analyst, both of whom are with Bloomberg Government. We've been referencing Bloomberg Business Week's latest cover, Babies, the Politics of the Fiscal Cliff are Outrageous. The Economic Thinking is Even Worse. The deal that was brokered was basically done through Mitch McConnell and the Vice President, Joe Biden.
Right.
Was it a matter of the president and John Boehner throwing their hands up in the air going, I can't deal with this anymore?
Well, they hit a wall in their talks,
right.
And then it shifted initially to Harry Reid and Mitch McConnell, mm-hmm. the majority and minority leader in the Senate, and they hit a wall. And it was Mitch McConnell who said on the floor of the Senate the Sunday before New Year's Eve that he had called the vice president and asked him to see if he could intervene in any way.
He got out of the pool, put his clothes back on.
Wherever he was at the time, Biden came back. And you know what? Biden and McConnell have a long history of working together. They've
right.
both been in, when Biden was in the Senate, they had been together for a number of decades. So that kind of long-term relationship allows you to get over the short-term give and take of politics. And I think that relationship may have saved the day in terms of getting a deal. Harry Reid could have forced a vote on what the president had been asking for all along with this $250,000 threshold. That may not have gotten over the point of becoming law, and we might still be arguing about the fiscal cliff right now. So McConnell and Biden, their efforts certainly saved the day on some level.
All right. Well, we'll get off the fiscal cliff for now and talk about something that they have also made a little bit of progress on, and that would be Hurricane Sandy relief
right.
efforts. Where are we with these efforts?
Well, the president and the administration asked for about $60 billion.
Mm-hmm.
The Senate in December passed a bill that would provide $60 billion. The details were different, but the overall size of the package was the same. The House didn't take it up before they left, to the dismay of many Northeast members, Republican and Democrat, who took to the House floor and kind of denounced this decision by leadership to cancel a vote that was never put on a piece of paper saying we're going to vote today, but all indications were leading up to that evening that they were going to. The House, right when the 113th Congress convened, the House passed a bill right away to allow the flood insurance program to borrow more money because they were going to hit that deadline sometime this week. when the House comes back next week, they're going to look at the rest of the package. So we're talking about $50 billion that they have left to deal with. And that's FEMA money. It's housing money. It's community development, block grants. It's money that would go to these states and help provide long-term and short-term relief.
One of the things that's interesting about this, and Lauren and I have talked about, is that part of the politics around breaking it into two pieces is it allows members who would prefer to have offsets for the disaster spending included in the bill to have their day in court, to have their chance on the House floor to offer amendments that would cut other programs to pay for the disaster relief. Now, this breaks precedent to a significant degree with the practice that's obtained since the 1990 budget deal.
Looking at the 113th Congress, what are the topics that they're going to be taking up as we make our way into 2013, basically the first quarter? Right. It's going to be jam-packed with lots of decisions that need to be made.
Well, the next quarter, going back to those three points that we've referenced, the debt limit, the spending cuts taking effect March 1st unless something's done, and then the March 27th expiration of the continuing resolution, which funds the government agencies. Those three things will have to be dealt with, or sure. You know, there's consequences if there's not, including the dreaded shutdown word. Beyond that, though, and for the rest of the year, Congress is going to be looking at things like immigration. The president's made it a priority after the November election results. Many members of Congress have said, hey, we need to do something about this. So I would see action on that in maybe the first 6 months of the year, if not the first 3 months. I think the committees are going to want to have a chance to weigh in on that, have hearings, mark up legislation, and bring it to the floor. I think if there's one trend you might see this year, it's fewer deals being negotiated by the leaders and more action on the House and Senate floors, where members have the chance to weigh in, offer their different policy proposals, and get votes on them.
Lauren's hit on a really important point. Moving towards what is called regular order, doing things through the committee process, bringing them to the floor, offering amendments, giving everybody a chance, it creates buy-in. Whereas if it's negotiated by only a few people in a small room, everybody else is on the outside looking in, and it's harder to get them to vote for the done deal at the end of the day. Other issues that may come up this year that Lauren and I have talked about include sort of the other shoe to drop on tax reform, and that's on the corporate side. There are also some other issues that may come up this year. Corps of Engineers reauthorization. It's kind of caught up in the fight about earmarking, because traditionally Congress decides where each project will take place for the Corps of Engineers.
Right.
So that's something they've got to wrestle with. There's some other transportation issues that they need to wrestle with.
The Farm Bill is going to come back. That was an issue that it kind of lingered toward the end of the year, and these news stories about the price of milk doubling.
Oh my gosh, I was just about to say, right. I felt like I was in the middle of a snowstorm all of a sudden.
It was amazing that you had gotten to this point where all the media were covering the fact that the milk prices were going to spike, and it forced action on all they did was extend current law, or what had been current law, into September 30th of this year. But there's major changes, everyone agrees, that are needed to the farm program. In fact, there's these direct payments to farmer that the legislation that had been considered last year would have eliminated that. And instead, we've extended those into the rest of this year. So a lot of the farmers and farm advocacy groups are going to be watching this debate very closely. I think that'll pick up relatively early in the year once Congress really gets going.
It's going to be an interesting first quarter of 2013, albeit the entire year will be extremely interesting as new members take their seats and figure out what they've truly gotten themselves into.
Right.
The cover of Bloomberg Business Week, if you want to take a look at it, go out and find it, BloombergBusinessWeek.com. Babies, the politics of the fiscal cliff are outrageous.
There is some whining on Capitol Hill, always.
As evident by that cover. Their names are Cameron Luthy and, of course, our friend Lauren Duggan. Thank you very much for being a part of the program.
Absolutely.
Thanks.
Thanks to Matt Zisman for being a part of the program. His study, $1 billion in 2013 NASA Contracting Opportunities, is available now. You can follow us on Twitter at BGov. For show updates, be sure to follow me at Alan L. Scott. We'll do this again next Thursday at 11 a.m. as we have plenty more to say about the business impact of government actions. For BGov's Capital Impact on Federal News Radio 1500 AM, I'm Alan Scott.